Hello and welcome to the China Business Brief, a podcast by the China Britain Business Council, where we explain the latest news relevant to anyone working in or with the world's second largest economy. I'm Joe Cash, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Todd Hall, Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford, for an episode in which we're going to focus on some of the more frustrating punditry pitfalls that we've noticed emerging in China commentary of late. To spice up today's episode, there is some accompanying reading, if you fancy it. The links have been included in the description below. But this discussion came about after I read a great short piece by Todd in the St. Anthony's International Review, and I would recommend you check it out. It's free to read, and it's a great introduction to today's conversation. It's also only 4 pages long. In addition to teaching at the university, Todd is also director of its China Centre, and his research interests lie in international relations theory, particularly the intersection of emotion, effect, and foreign policy, and of course, Chinese foreign policy. So we're in good hands for today's conversation. Todd, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
For those of you who haven't yet read Todd's article, in short, China is getting more attention in the press. There are an increasing number of people who seem to have an opinion on China, be they specialists or non-specialists. It's a really good article that I really enjoyed reading. It starts very dramatically, that's all I'll say. But I suppose the first question is, as a China specialist watching the growing commentary on the country, what are some of your biggest frustrations in the British media at present?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think there is a lot of good reporting out there on China, especially given the conditions under which journalists have to operate. I mean, People's Republic of China does not make it easy. Reporting in China faces a lot of hurdles. Possibly the greatest frustration I have is the way in which there's this replication of what one might call opacity and mystique. And so just to give an example, I recently did an exercise where I compared two articles from a well-known global news magazine. And one article was on the US and Biden's infrastructure plan. And it discussed what you might expect, right? The various factions and players in Congress, interests for and against, bureaucratic hurdles. It also mentioned by name various politicians, Schumer, Pelosi, Graham. And what it did not do is it did not frame the issue in terms of grand history of American infrastructure, harking back to America's first trains across the West. It did not use this as an opportunity to question, you know, or indict democratic collapse. And it did not once refer to America as the eagle, thankfully. I read an article from the same outlet on the PRC's Belt and Road Initiative. And this starts, of course, with historic sweep back to 15th century voyages of Zheng He. And apart from him, there's only one other Chinese individual mentioned, that's Xi Jinping. And then nothing was said of the internal politics of China. In fact, it cited more what non-Chinese Western commentators by name that cited Chinese actors. It did mention several large Chinese companies, but we're told they're giant state enterprises with close links to the Communist Party's leaders. It didn't tell us if they were competitors or coordinating their efforts, who their heads were, what incentives they faced, et cetera, et cetera. And so, although one good thing, if I highlight one good thing, it didn't refer to China as a dragon. But the simple point here, when you compare these two things, one, when you get to the PRC, there's this way in which we discuss it that sometimes makes it more foreign than it is. The PRC also has bureaucratic politics, different players, political logics behind its choices. But there's a strong strand in commentary in the PRC that somehow wants to present it as mystic or ancient or link it back to something about its ancient culture or history, or also treat it as a superhuman entity in the way we don't often treat other states.
So this mystique, there is increasing pressure on people working in businesses in the UK that might not wholly be focused on China, who suddenly have to pay far more attention to China and having to explain developments in China and how China acts as a business place, how China acts as an actor in international relations, and are struggling to break down the kind of concepts of Confucianism, how important Confucius thought is to China today, how important the oft-mentioned 5,000 years of history are to a regime that's only been in power for 70 years, which is very different to imperial dynasties before it. What are your basics for China watching? If you are somebody who is working on China in a company, you have to report on what is happening there. How can you avoid being blinded by the grandeur of the 5,000 years, Confucianism, everything the party says is what the party does?
Well, there's a lot of things to unpack there. I think first is the sort of the story of how we relate Chinese history to behavior today, or how we relate sort of ancient Chinese thought or ancient Chinese writings on strategy to the way in which the Chinese Communist Party is behaving today, for example. I think I'd make 2 points there. One is that history generally, and China is no exception, often has been told not as an objective chronicle of events, but in a way that retrospectively serves the needs of the present, often by those who are in power. Two is it's not the history per se, it's the way in which history is told and retold at present that then those stories and what those stories then do is in terms of providing justifications and such, as opposed to quote unquote objective chronicle of events. I also, though, find that many of the things that one sees, for example, in terms of Kissinger saying that Chinese think about strategy in terms of the game of Go, whereas Westerners think about it in chess and such. I find those kinds of pronouncements to be a lot like sort of horoscopes. They're so broad that you can almost expand them to fit anything, explain any behavior. And at the same time, they're really bad for planning your day. And so I don't find those types of analyses very useful personally. Now, then the question comes, okay, so what do we look at and who do we look at? And I think, you know, it's very interesting when you look at the media and you look at what's described about China, you know, you get a lot of focus on Xi Jinping, which is natural and makes a lot of sense. But who are some of the other characters that we see often talked about in particular American or European news outlets? Three characters that come to mind are, for example, the PRC speakers of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hua Chunying and Dali Jin, who have been in the news quite a bit recently. They're sort of described as these wolf warrior diplomats. Hu Xijin, who's the editor for Global Times as well. Now, these are individuals who've been very outspoken. They're almost troll-like in how they engage Western media, speak to governments in North America, Europe, etc. But to be honest, the effect these individuals have on shaping PRC foreign policy is relatively minimal. They've been very good at producing provocative sound bites and incendiary tweets, and they've garnered a lot of attention because of it. You know, you compare that, for example, to Wang Wenbin, who's another foreign ministry speaker who's gotten a lot less attention because he hasn't stood out as much in being provocative. But this is very different than those who are actually making policy. And so this is not focusing on what Xi Jinping's saying. It's not focusing on what the standing committee is discussing, what's happening in terms of promotions or bureaucratic reorganizations or certain things that suggest that major shifts may be coming. And so, and those are those latter places are the places that policy are made. The second thing I find really interesting is this exercise that one might call the listening for the sound of one hand clapping in official discourse. And these are the places where official actors argue against debate partners or viewpoints, these third party viewpoints that are not necessarily represented in the official discourse, that if you went online and searched for them, you wouldn't find them. But there are these viewpoints that they're arguing very strongly against. And it's interesting because this suggests that there's something in the system. There's some people or some actors in the system making that argument. And there's an attempt to officially counter it. And so while you don't see that argument, you do see the argument against that very vehemently, which suggests that actually is a debate that's going on.
The comment about the one hand clapping, unfortunately, it takes an amazing amount of time and resource to find them. But if you dive deep into Chinese media, there are many stories. Most recently regarding COVID-19, you have had senior people in China's health apparatus say, well, perhaps we should think about learning to live with the virus. Or perhaps in the world of trade, you know, China should look to boost the role of SOEs in its economy. There's also a resource that I'm aware that lots of China watchers are talking about at the moment, and I only really stumbled across it this morning, called Reading the China the Dream, where a professor in the US is translating lots of pieces by Chinese intellectuals that either support or run counter to the idea that the party is putting out there. So there is, of course, a lot of material for people to be getting into and reading through. One point that you did mention, which is a particular bugbear for me, is when I see articles, the BBC is quite often guilty of this, of the Global Times has said XYZ, with the Global Times, of course, sitting under People's Daily, but not really being the mouthpiece of the party, being far more like China's equivalent of the Daily Mail.
I mean, it's interesting just on that point. I mean, my understanding is that there have been articles published by the Global Times that have been at points recalled or there have been official orders go down not to circulate as well. So it's not always sticking completely to the official line. And the other issue is that they make money off of clicks, right? And so English language provocative arguments that get a lot of clicks get advertising revenue. And so there's also a commercial incentive there too, to do these things.
I mean, a very practical tip that was once given to me about looking at Global Times, China Daily, and trying to, another bad China take expression, but I'm going to use it out of habit, read the tea leaves, is when there was the entities list a couple of years ago and China was threatening to ban companies that seemed to do things that displeased it, companies took to looking at the front pages. And if, for example, Caterpillar was on the front page of China Daily, you could assume that Caterpillar wasn't on the unreliable entities list. Now, the unreliable entities list still hasn't been published, but nothing bad happened to Caterpillar. So maybe there was some truth in that strategy. But taking our China reading and applying it perhaps more practically to the concerns of businesses, and I'm thinking particularly businesses that are looking at the Belt and Road, the GBA, they're trying to understand how these investment opportunities have manifested themselves, how they're going to have to work with the Chinese government to become involved. And there's always a lot of talk, well, the Belt and Road is China's massive foreign policy push to establish dominance over Russia's former sphere of influence from some Central Asia and into Europe, and to have a presence on Europe's back door. And the GBA is a large top-down initiative by the government to kind of bring Hong Kong back into the fold, even though it seems a lot of the analysis suggests that the initiatives of the GBA and the Belt and Road are actions that the local government has already taken, but the Chinese government is now branding BRI, GBA. How can companies best conceptualize the role of the party, then the government, then the regulators, and then business in these grand initiatives?
Well, I think it's very tricky because, of course, it's such a broad, I mean, if we take the BRI, it's such a broad, sprawling thing that it's hard to capture with any one label. I think what I've seen is that you have to be very careful to separate out the official stated aspirations of the BRI and how it's actually implemented. And here I would recommend, there's some wonderful work out there by Minier of Boston University, James Riley at the University of Sydney, Thomas Hale here at Oxford, among others. But the long story short, I think the conclusion of much of this work is that there's this central story about the BRI that's being propagated, and one that's very Xi Jinping centric. Indeed, it's very much created sort of as a shisho. But the implementation, for the most part, is much more left to bottom-up proposals and the initiative of local and or commercial actors. And in some cases, it's rebranding things that already existed. In some cases, it's creating things to speak to what might get BRI approval. In some cases, it's sort of stretching the policy to include things that probably wouldn't have been originally intended. But the result is that I think we see then, for example, BRI projects that are far more diverse and scattered than one would expect given the articulated strategic vision.
I mean, there's a wonderful article by Tim Summers on how Yunnan province in the deep south, which is considered to be a kind of smaller, dare I say, less significant province in the grand scheme of kind of China's domestic policy, has managed to get a number of concessions from Beijing for the Belt and Road, because it's aware that there is this pressure point that Beijing needs Yunnan's agreement and support to use it to kind of go out to East Asia with the Belt and Road. And actually, these smaller provinces can pressure the center. And I suppose that's another point worth mentioning. Often there is this idea that because something has been laid out by Beijing and it's come from the top echelons of government, it's actually going to come into being. But there are, of course, lots of other actors in China. You know, how can we understand the difference between kind of what the party is wanting to do and what kind of leaders in China's business, social, and kind of non-central government political circles want to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because I think often the business leaders also will frame what they want in ways that speak to what the party wants to do. I think what we have to be careful too is so the party, on the one hand, the party can, and the Chinese government can concentrate a lot of power and effort on certain things. And so if it wants to make something happen and get done and it focuses a lot of effort on it, it probably will be able to at least exercise authority over those that it's targeting in a focused fashion. But China, the People's Republic of China, is a big place, and there's a lot of different things to pay attention to. And so one of the things that I've sort of been playing with recently is this idea of the difference between party craft and statecraft. And so if we understand statecraft as strategic, coordinated, plan and target oriented, seeking to accomplish clear goals and following bureaucratic rules and regulations, the contrast is that partycraft is, and I think this is something you see quite frequently in the PRC, is involves these political campaigns and messaging, images and slogans. And they start off with big, large slogans that others then rush to fill with content. And it seeks to enroll followers and mobilizes and rewards demonstrations of political loyalty and enthusiasm. So you have these top centralized efforts at partycraft that mobilize the information apparatus of the PRC and are very good at messaging, very good at getting people to show demonstrations of loyalty and get on script and all these things. And that's something quite different than the very methodical, top-down, everyone marching in lockstep understanding of statecraft. And I want to be clear, you know, that when I talk about partycraft and statecraft, this is not to say that they necessarily map onto the party organs versus the state. They're different types of doing policy. And just like the PRC party state mingles the party and the state, partycraft and statecraft are both to different degrees exercised by different parts of the party state. But they are distinct, I think, forms of political practice distinguished by their methods. If that makes sense. And partycraft has its advantages. It can spur actors into motion. It can stimulate mass excitement activity. It's skilled at propaganda and extraordinarily focused on promoting widespread participation in grand visions. And I think we see a lot of that with the BRI.
I hoped that we'd provided listeners with some practical tips that would make it easier for them to understand China when they're reading about it on their day-to-day. But I think one of the things that can't be overstated is that there needs to be a broader vocabulary for understanding China. There are these concepts, you know, partycraft, that exist, I guess. There is party politics in the UK that has a bearing on the way that the UK acts as an actor, but is not as vital as in China. One of the other things that I've noticed cropping up in analyses of bad punditry on China is the idea that expressions and terms that we use in the West to try and understand China, while perhaps it's helpful that articles are increasingly trying to make China and the people in China sound more relatable to Western audiences and the way that the Chinese government works more relatable to the way that Western democratic governments work. But are we reducing China to orientalized ideas that a Western audience perhaps feels comfortable with, but then fails to actually explain what's taking place in China?
I mean, it's an interesting, because it touches, I think, on two things, actually. Because one is, in seeking to familiarize, do we erase important differences? And I think the process of familiarization is very important, getting away from that opacity and mystique. I think, for example, audiences in the UK would feel very familiar with the United States, even for some who may never even have been there in their life, but that certain concepts, certain ideas, and things that are unique to the United States even would still seem somewhat understandable. And so how do we, in trying to explain to the People's Republic of China and the lives of ordinary Chinese even, are we using sometimes concepts that don't particularly, that map on not necessarily comfortably onto what their lived experiences are or the way in which society is organized. I think that's very tricky. That's a very interesting point. And so in some ways, this requires much more sort of the explanation, right? This is what this means. This is when we refer to this, this is what, and those easy terms of reference that we have we may need different terms. And so the other thing, though, I think we need to be fair is spread the blame equally as well, because I don't think Beijing makes it easy to get insight. I mean, so there's one thing is the terms we use, but also in terms of making sense of policymaking processes, I think one reason that we do sometimes project these things onto the People's Republic of China is because we don't have as much insight into how policies are being made, how compromises are being made, what the deals are that are being made between interest groups. If you think about analyses of the United States, there's a lot more transparency there. Beijing has made it difficult to do the reporting that one needs to do to clarify some of those things, that the lack of transparency and insight into how the PRC system works is not just a function of quote unquote bad commentary. It's also a function of the fact that there are lots of hurdles to understand what's going on behind the scenes. And where you don't have transparency, it's very easy to project certain things or to mysticize them or to create conspiracy theories, because one doesn't have an idea of what the compromises are being made, what the logics are. People's Republic of China, that's the Chinese Communist Party, very much embraces you do not just understand sort of self-exoticizing discourse. And it serves Beijing to say that there's a gap of foreignness between China and other parts of the world, because then you can dismiss disagreeing viewpoints as foreign and Western. And othering dissenting viewpoints or different viewpoints as foreign or exotic or whatever is a tactic by no means limited to the PRC, but Beijing does lay it on particularly thickly. So this combination of you can't understand because we're different, with a non-transparent or an effort to create a semi-non-transparent policymaking process, does also help cultivate those types of comments.
Well, we've managed to bring things very nicely full circle back to the difference between the US and why we're not all writing about the US's imminent downfall and the collapse of democracy, and China and how we put these premonitions onto China and Beijing. I mean, I think we've tried in the last 20 minutes to be helpful and to give people some practical tips on China reading. Todd, thanks for coming on the podcast. This has been great.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for listening. And catch us again in 2 weeks' time when we'll have another episode of China Business Brief. Goodbye for now. China Business Brief is a podcast brought to you by the China Britain Business Council. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you're subscribed. To find out more about our other events and activities, do check out our website at www.cbbc.org.